This podcast is brought to you by PrideNZ.com and funded through a generous grant from the Legacy Fund of the Second Asia Pacific Out Games.
Well, a very brief background. I mean, I grew up in the country, so I'm used to a number eight wire mentality of fixing things. I went to night school and then to university and trained as a psychologist, so you have to be fairly creative doing therapy. I got ill, left that, and became an artist, which I had done art. I was intending to be an art teacher back in my very early days. So art, and so that gave me an idea about display and so on, things that were useful for the museum. And then the museum came about because I went to the Outlines conference in Wellington, and I had this quilt that I'd made out of t-shirts and a great big badge collection, thinking Argan's would be nice down there, they could display it and introduce people to Argan's with it. Everybody loved the two pieces, but they said, oh no, we can't take objects, not objects that big. And so I came back to Auckland, and I had a small group of people that I was trying to encourage to do things for Argan's. I'd been on the trust of Argan's for a while, and I won't go into that, but it's a bit personal. arguments with a certain person. But anyway, I was encouraging people still to send stuff, because Auckland is not good at sending things to Argan's. And so I talked to this group, and we said, well, maybe we need a museum of lesbian objects. There's all these things. What's going to happen to them? We just tossed those ideas around, and that's really how it was born. And then we thought about, well, what would we call it? Very naive, totally ignorant about the requirements of a museum, I have to say. And we spent ages discussing. We wanted an old-fashioned name, and somebody said Charlotte, and I said, Charlotte, that's great. There were two Charlottes involved with the KG Club, the first lesbian club in Auckland. So that's how it became, Charlotte Museum Trust. We've applied to the charities and got registration. That was a bit slow, but we got there. I think it was probably sitting on some legal officer's desk who was having a bit of a problem with the lesbian part of it. But anyway, we got it through. So, and we've had no problems since.
Let's just rewind a wee bit, because you've covered some really big things in the establishment of an archive or a museum. Can you just take me back and just first of all describe what Argan's is?
Argan's is the Lesbian and Gay Archives of New Zealand, and they collect books, magazines, papers and personal private letters and any information regarding lesbian, gay, transgender people in New Zealand.
And so they weren't able to accept your subjects?
Objects. Yeah. Yes.
And what's an object encompass? What is that?
Well, an object is a three-dimensional thing, which of course does have certain requirements in terms of storage, and they're basically a paper archive, really. They do have a few badges and posters of paper anyway. There are probably a few, maybe T-shirts or something, that are significant that they may have from the very early times, but not the sort of things that we envisage that would be lost in the realms of time, that families would move into when a lesbian died and probably just dump it all in a second-hand shop and have no idea of the meaning and significance of, you know, the first gay liberation T-shirt or things like that that people have kept, because they are significant and they represent a significant time in gay and lesbian lives in New Zealand.
So prior to the Charlotte Museum, was there any other institution in New Zealand that was collecting specifically queer objects?
No, and in fact the opposite was occurring, that when people mentioned people like Frances Hodgkins, they never mentioned her relationship with Dorothy Kate Richmond. The relationship of Catherine Mansfield, the same. So there is absolutely no L word mentioned in New Zealand museums until just very recently, when there was a display in Te Papa, and they managed to say the L word, and Motet. But what did Motet do? They were doing something on the 1950s, and they put the Christchurch murder.
Now,
Museum of Transport and Technology in Auckland. And we felt a bit incensed about that we are only represented as murderers. That's it. Or part of the homosexual law reform. which we didn't get any rights out of that until much later. So there are lots of other, particularly the lesbian culture. And people have so often said, well, why isn't there a gay men's museum? What about gay men's culture? And I said, well, it's much more accepted mainstream than lesbians. There's a certain allergy, I think, in the mainstream for lesbian. Some well-known artists who are, in fact, lesbian hide their lesbianism in the art world. So it's difficult, I think, to... And, for instance, if you want to see some gay men's work or art relating to gay men's lives, you in Auckland, you can just go to the Pa Homestead. There's lots of phalluses there. There's, you know, there's a whole... the collector obviously has a bent in that direction, and whereas there's nothing like that for lesbians. I can't think of anywhere I could suggest people go other than to somebody's iris garden, perhaps is about the only thing around that one could suggest might have an inkling of lesbianism. So there was nothing, and there is so little about our lives that it makes it very hard for young people to see any positiveness. Like, many lesbians have been, because they didn't marry and they didn't have children in the old days and often had a female companion, they did amazing things, but it's not recorded. We never knew about, for instance, Amy Kane and Daisy Isaacs, and they set up the first professional theatre in New Zealand. Well, we didn't know that. No one's pulled that information out until we did some research on early lesbian theatre. And the same with music. We discovered this very very avant-garde composer, musician, who's she lives in America now. I think she was probably too avant-garde for New Zealand, who recorded drowning pianos and burning pianos, Anea Lockwood. Amazing stuff she has done, even recording the Danube. Now, we didn't know. She's very open as a lesbian. But we didn't know that until we did the research and found her. And so one of the things that I feel that the Charlotte Museum has done is actually find things that were already being lost, that had barely made the surface and were going back down again.
So prior to the establishment of the Charlotte Museum, were you personally collecting objects, material?
I did, yes. I think my initial collection was really, I was involved in lots of activism, so I had lots of badges, and I used to delight in working in the Mount Eden prison and wearing Better Gay Than Grumpy to work, particularly because most of the prison officers were so homophobic that it wound them up a treat, and they really had, they were busy trying to do other things to us, so it was my counter. But the objects, my children have tended to buy me things that are womanly, like statues of women and, oh, Mama like this. And even my grandchildren, I mean, they were busy out shopping one day, and she was only about 5 or 6. Oh, get that for Miriam, get that for Miriam, she says to her father. Because it was a drink bottle that had a nice dancing woman on. So I suppose some of that was not really intentional in the early days. I would just see something and like it and buy it. When I started to have a little bit of money, for a long time I was really poor, rearing 5 children on my own and not having much, paying off a house, you know, the usual things. So when I could buy a few nice, like a nice plate or something that had a woman on, I tended to do that as a little treat for myself. For the few years that I was working full time, and that didn't last very long because of my health. So I had these things, and then I thought, you know, everybody must have things. And you go to women's houses, and they're full of bits and pieces, and some lesbian art. They tend to buy other lesbians' work and so on. And I thought that's all. There was a whole era of 70s and 80s. Where we even had a Dyke directory where you can get a lesbian electrician, things like that, plumbers and so on. So all that's gone now. We're sort of so-called assimilated and, you know, incorporated into the great big world society. But people still don't like the L word, and I think that era would be lost. No one would realise. I had some students come to the museum just the other day, and they were amazed that women, and it was just things about women, that there were no women in the ambulance service until 1982. My girlfriend at the time was trying to get into the ambulance service and waited for 2 years to get in. And, of course, there was the whole controversy over the fire service. They upped the physical fitness thing so high that even the men couldn't do it. I mean, they got ridiculous. So there was all that going on in the 80s that people didn't realise. And we're often asked, well, why did the lesbian clubs close down? And because the police raided them. Why did the police raid them? Lesbianism wasn't illegal. But women couldn't hold a licence to sell liquor. If you didn't sell liquor, you didn't get enough money in to pay the rent. So you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And nowadays there aren't any lesbian clubs anyway. The rents are too high. And mostly they have nights here and there using bar staff that are on the establishment, and the money all goes into the establishment and not to the lesbian community. And people say, well, why is the museum so poor? We don't even have a coordinator at the moment because we only got a $4,000 grant and can't pay a coordinator with $4,000 for a year. It's just stupid stuff. And it is, because we're not a rich community at all. People talk about the pink dollar. Well, I think the lavender one is a bit tatty. And another thing, the lesbian community itself, because it's poor, a third of them are rearing children at any time, and often they're looking after elderly relatives, so they'll often give up a full-time job to do that. So there's a whole lot of factors, not only just the equity issues of getting less pay for the same job.
The Outlines conference that you were talking about that kind of first sparked the idea, when was that?
I think it was 2003, from my memory.
And can you remember your reaction at the conference when you were wanting to present this material and suddenly found that you couldn't?
I could understand, because I had been to the old archives when they were in Bulcott Street, you know, when that was firebombed, and that's how it became involved, or taken over really by the Alexander Turnbull Library, made a space for the archives because they were valuable. Well, someone was persuaded in the government that they were valuable. I'm not sure that the whole government was behind it being considered valuable at the time, but enough people were behind it, and it got involved in the National Library and incorporated under the umbrella of the National Library. And so I could understand that there would be restrictions and so on, and I could see that collecting paper is much easier than objects. And then you have to have to keep just objects for their sake isn't quite as meaningful as displaying them. So that was really a museum, and I really didn't know what a museum needed. And so it's a bit like ignorance is bliss. Off I sailed forth with this idea, thinking I could set it up and, you know, we could get some funding and someone would run it. And
so that whole idea of coming from the conference in 2003, coming back up to Auckland, what kind of idea did you have in your head? What was the initial thought?
Oh, just maybe we could have a room somewhere. And I did put some feelers out to Te Papa. I started to ask questions all around about what was involved, as you do. I sort of was doing a bit of research. And a Te Papa visitor, you know, one of the visiting officers, came to my house to see what sorts of things I was talking about. And I made a little bit of an inventory of what sorts of things that I could see go in it. and I really felt that I was under scrutiny, that I might have some Maori artefacts or something. I felt that their focus was not on lesbian culture at all, but that I might somehow be transgressing some museum rule or something. That's how I felt at the time. I mean, it might not have been valid way of thinking, but I didn't feel too welcomed, I think.
So the person from Te Papa was coming...
There were two of them came. Mm.
They were coming to look at your collection with the eye that you were going to set up some kind of museum rather than deposit this material with Te Papa.
Yes, that had never occurred to me because many of the lesbians who had done work, particularly like a ceramic vulva or something, would be loath perhaps to have them in a public institution where there's no control over how they might be displayed. The other thing is when the sets of things, they will often break them up and just... So if ever the museum was taken over like by an institution like Auckland Museum or Te Papa, they would put it in storage and they would fish out maybe Pyro Corneille's stuff, which they were interested in, the work that I had of hers, and just display that. And they wouldn't necessarily say that she was lesbian, of course. So it would be lost. And the whole meaning behind it, the sense of pride that young people get when they come to the museum, wow, you know, they made that then, and, you know, it's, you know, this and that. They lived like that, and you know, they suddenly realise there's a history for them. And that it really helps with their sense of pride and identity. You don't get that in institutions that are heterosexually based. And they won't interpret. The best thing I've ever seen in Te Papa was a hint when they had a display of Francis Hodgkin's work, and there was a hint, they'd taken a piece of one of Francis Hodgkin's letters where she was saying about that they were going over to Europe and she was so excited that she was going with Dorothy Cape Richmond. And now they'd taken that snippet out of the letter. They could have taken other bits out of the letter about going to Europe, but they took that bit. And I thought, well, that curator is in the know, and they've left that little bit. So it's a hint that if we know, we can pick up. But a young person wouldn't necessarily make that connection. They would have to know the history of Francis Hodgkin's to make that connection. So these little pieces, and they might be small, actually are enormous to a young person growing up.
So for you, thinking about establishing the Charlotte Museum, was that large in your mind? It wasn't just about collecting objects, it was about how they were displayed and how they were curated.
It was much more about getting information out to young people. I did not want young people to be like I was, without, totally ignorant, and I think I've told you before, looked in the encyclopedia and saw that homosexuals had arrested development, so I thought they were all short. You know, that sort of, and it led to, you know, suicide attempts and things. So I don't want young people to be going through that. I certainly don't want to see any young children, not even just my grandchildren, because they have plenty of models around them, but other children who don't, who live in small towns, like I, small country places, they don't have role models. And they don't necessarily have information. And some of the information on the internet, for instance, is too much based on sex and not really about living a life. And not so much about love, even. So sometimes that misses the point.
So do you think it's really important at the start, when you're even considering doing something like this, to actually have a very strong idea about what you're actually wanting to achieve in terms of, you know, I'm collecting these objects, why am I collecting them? What's it all about? For you, it was about...
It was to have it for future generations, that it wouldn't be lost, and that there was a story there that would be helpful to the next generation and so on, and that would that one would add to it as we went along, so that it had. So you would end up in 100 years' time with, 150 years of lesbianism in New Zealand, which would be marvellous, because we don't have that. Currently, we have bits and pieces.
Did you have any national institutions like Te Papa trying to bring your collection into their collections, or were they open about you having a separate space?
They were quite open. They didn't offer for anything because I don't think it was meaningful to them. They saw bits of, some nice glass pieces. We've had, of course, since we've had lots of some very special stuff donated to the museum, like replicas of... the goddess figures from the Natural History Museum in Vienna. So we have other things, of course, that once we've set up that have been added, that people have donated. Some beautiful pieces from Crete, from the museum there. So some lovely silverware that a lesbian brought back when she was right into the sort of goddess movement and so on, and she has since moved on to something else and busy climbing the Himalayas, I think, these days. So, she donated all this wonderful stuff, and we all are able to share it. So it's grown since that first bit. They probably thought, what did I have, maybe 70 things? Wasn't very much, really. But now, we're up in the hundreds of things. And one of the things that came out of it was the collection of music, that we have all these vinyl records. And we don't just collect lesbian music. We have many, many women's records, because most of the lesbians collected lots of women's. But then we've got Fleetwood Mac and so on. And we held these Leslie tune nights. And people say, pull out a Fleetwood, play this, I fell in love with so-and-so then. And you get all these stories, wonderful stories of love. And I guess lesbians are very romantic, really. They are about love. I mean, that's what's most meaningful. I mean, we have a thing that was last night, actually, which is why I'm a bit tired, Dykes on Mics. And so, I mean, I often tell them a story, and last night I was able to just say about the passing of a musician who died last week in Waiheke, and I thought, no one's heard her play these songs. I heard her play them in the 70s. And they were just, they are so lesbian. I mean, she was told at the time, you can't sing those, they're too sexual. And one of them goes, never put your finger in a dyke. Never put your finger unless you want to linger. You could be stuck there all your life because a dyke don't grunt, roll over and say, that's it, baby, be on your way. A dyke, you'll turn the other cheek. Baby, you could be there for a week. Now, that is a very, very lesbian song. There's no two ways about it. And it's lost in the realm of time, because when I interviewed her with Andrew Whiteside 2 years ago for a film we made on lesbian music, and she couldn't really remember the words until I reminded her what they were, because I had fortunately written them down, and I'd written down another song about, it's been a pleasure, come again, come around for afternoon tea or something, but I haven't got all the words to that, and she couldn't remember that one at all, and she couldn't really, I did try and remind her of the tune of it, but she did remember the put the finger in the dark one, and she sang it for us. So we do have her singing it at the end of that film, which is just stunning that we have that. But there's a lot of other things that we will have lost. Many of the lesbians who wrote music in the 70s and 80s, and Hazel actually said that it was like a rallying call for the community. And it was. I mean, you just went everywhere where there was a concert or where someone was playing who was lesbian. And all the lesbians would turn up, wherever it was. And it was a bit like a rallying call for a community at the time. And many of those songs are lost. People have moved on, they got proper jobs, and their scraps of paper or cigarette boxes that they wrote their music on are lost. And it's a bit like the Top Twins. So much was in their heads. And working with the Symphonia, they had to learn that someone had to write the music, the script down, so the orchestra could play it. So I think the Top Twins are a good example of actually how much of our music could be lost, and probably is lost.
So things like Dykes on Mics, does that, that's another way of passing down history, isn't it, through kind of oral traditions? Does the Charlotte Museum have any part of that kind of thing?
Well, yes. Our Leslie Tunes Night do that in a different way, by using music that's recorded and people talking about why it's significant for them, and how they played a lesbian. Like when the word lesbian was first on a recorded music, the gay women, the sporty sort of dykes who didn't ever use the word lesbian, this is in their 70s, they were shocked to hear someone like Alex Dobgan raunching out the word lesbian. Any woman can be a lesbian. I mean, they drank their beer rather quickly, I noticed. We were homophobic ourselves. And that internalised homophobia means that even today there are lesbians who do not like the word lesbian. So it wasn't just the female companions that we often call women who lived with other women in the early times. It was many, many other women. And still today, they slide around that word. It obviously doesn't necessarily have the positive connotations it has for me, because I discovered it, with feminism. So it was sort of together with feminism, and I both liked both the words, so it had no negative connotations for me at all. And I also had a background, of course, with my parents into Greek literature and stuff, so that probably helped elevate the word for me. But I think for many others it's not such a grand word.
Just getting back to the whole National Institution coming in and looking at your collection, do you think if I was a small... Or if I had a small collection of material, do you think there is a benefit from a large national institution taking on that?
It only would be if they had a vested interest in it, and most large institutions don't have vested interests in gay and lesbian issues or our history. They might have a vested interest if it was a criminal museum, of course I'm focusing on all that aspect, or a criminal display, for instance, and they would use us as part of their display. But it wouldn't necessarily be, like, one of the functions of a museum is about identity, national identity, but it's also about personal identity, which is tied up with your sense of national identity. And large institutions only concentrate on the national identity and not on anything personal. And I think that's where we still have high suicide rates amongst our young gay and lesbians, because we have overlooked that we have not provided them with mentors and with a sense of history. So I still feel quite strongly about that. Unfortunately, I'm probably be singing it to my grave.
So after that visit from Te Papa, what happened next? What was the next step for you?
That must have been around about 2006, I think, and I was already in the process of writing some policies and documents and getting a trust deed and I was on other trusts, so it was fairly easy for me to get a lawyer who was on the trust board of another trust to run over my trust deed. I'd just taken one off the net that was had lots of, I'd had the titles in both English and Maori, so I felt it was a good enough trust deed, and I just changed the principles to what I thought we needed, that our core values should have been collecting lesbian things, maybe a bit of feminist stuff, but the emphasis is really lesbian, and protecting them, conserving them, classifying them, recording history about them for future generations. And basically that vision stayed the same. So I suppose I didn't really consult with many people at all. because I just looked up things on the net for other institutions. And interesting, I think it might be a Melbourne museum, somebody over there, I think it was a gay man, definitely the way it's written, wrote a beautiful piece about challenging museums to display gay and lesbian things with gay and lesbian sort of titles and so on, to make it clear they were lesbian or gay. And I thought that was a wonderful piece, and I started to write up some stuff about feasibility, and so I did a feasibility sort of study and an assessment of what we would need, and I could see that at the lower end of the scale, all we needed was actually a room to put displays on and a little bit of storage space, and maybe even operate only once a month that it was open. So you could start on that scale. I mean, currently we're open to the public 2 days a week, but it's also open by appointment, so people can come and visit any time. They just have to ring the phone number, and I usually go and open it up, or I arrange for somebody else to go and do that. So, and that's without any coordinator, because we lost our funding for the coordinator. As you said before, $4,000 doesn't last for a year, and nobody can live on it. So we're operating very much at this point as volunteers.
At the start-up, was it just yourself, or were you opening it up to kind of some kind of community involvement or community discussion?
I certainly invited people. I talked about it with lots of my friends. I selected, carefully selected trustees who would be good at governance. There were lots of trustees, lots of potential trustees who were very interested in the concept of a museum and saw lots of possibilities of different things that they were interested in. But I felt that they didn't have the skills in governance that I was looking for. I wanted someone with, so I chose someone who was a teacher in a private school, but who had had experience in England, in negotiating that whole, the whole lesbian world in a much more homophobic environment. So I thought she would be good to counter me being out front, you know, a lesbian all over me, to something a bit more moderate. And I used my daughter because so much of the first part of the collection was my own personal things. And I thought if I dropped dead in the first few years, I needed to have a trustee, and I'd lent my daughter some money. So the arrangement was that if I dropped dead, she could pay someone to do what I was doing so that it wasn't lost because of that period of time, so that there would be enough money she would pay back to the museum instead of to the dead me or to her brothers. So that was the arrangement, so that we could get it established. So she's on the trust board, and then another friend of mine who's good with governance, who had been a public servant for many years, who also is fluent in German, which is useful because we do have a number of German magazines and so on, part of my collection. Paula Wallace, and then we have someone who's got a PhD in archaeology. And since then we've got Sissy on board and Denise Yates, who's the chair of the local board. So we've expanded our trustees, but always with the sight of good governance. Sadly, Christine went and worked in Australia, and so she did stay on the board for another year or so, and then decided she was permanently going to be over there, so she went off the board.
So what makes good governance?
People who understand the necessity to do things on time, that particularly with the charities trust is very strict in terms of how you're getting your annual your audited accounts in, and that's quite difficult when you have no money to pay an auditor and you're leaning on the goodwill of some accountant friend of a friend of a friend. It's tricky to get those things done on time. Also that we needed to have a lot of policies, and they needed to be really clear what the policies. I think we've written something like 65, 68 policies altogether.
What do they cover?
They cover enormous number of things. There's health and safety, there's security, there's financial, there's a whole lot of governance policies, like finance, about acquisitions, about deacquisitioning things. You know, if you've been given a whole lot of things and you might actually fill out an acquisition sheet for them all, and then you realise, well, no, this has no relevance to lesbianism, so you want to deacquisition it. In fact, it's better not to acquisition it in the first place. So rules around those sort of things, conservation rules, cataloguing rules. We even have a lesbian policy to make sure everyone understands what we mean by lesbian. We also have the library and the knowledge policy are now, we joined those together, I think. We've got an education policy, we've got it just goes on and on.
So
hospitality policy, you know.
that bank of policies, where did they all come from? Did you realise at the start that you would need those many?
No, I didn't realise we needed that number. The Te Papa standards is a good guideline, but by the time we started to work our way through the standards, we actually had most of those other policies in place, because as soon as I hit a problem, I would then think, oh, we need a policy on this, because so that if I have to tell someone something, then I think, well, we probably need a policy, we need to have that written down, and you call that, if you write something down, the instructions for something, you call it a policy. Fortunately, one of our trustees is the chief policy advisor for the Historic Places Trust. So that's been excellent in terms that I would lift policies off the net, change it for the Charlotte Museum, take out Melbourne Museum, put in Charlotte Museum, that sort of thing, tidy it up, make sure it was more appropriate to New Zealand, and then whisk it off to the trustees to read over and check and see what they thought, and they improved the English, because my English is not that good, and then we'd have it in place. And then we rechecked those when we employed. We managed to get some funding to employ someone to go over the standards, and she checked all our policies. She had a law background, and so she tightened them up even further with some of the legal issues that could have been a problem.
So do you think in hindsight, would you have got all that material in place before you established the museum, or is it okay and a valid way of just doing it as it kind of comes up?
I think it's better to do it as it comes up, because it's more practical. Otherwise, you'll have a whole lot of theory and no one will read it. But if you've had a problem and you've written something about the problem, then it's practical. Everybody knows why that policy is there and what it covers and why we need it, basically. You know, when we first started and was in the first building, we would get boxes left at our door, full of broadsheets. We could have drowned in broadsheets. But no, we systematically went through and tried to keep two copies of every broadsheet, and one or two we kept three copies. The very early ones we kept all that we were given. We were not given a lot of those, but the middle range, there were boxes and boxes of them. And so we had them free to a good home. We gave them to students and so on. So we sort of bantered them around. We never threw any out unless they were very badly damaged. But we've kept pretty much two copies of every broadsheet, and they're a great resource. Even though it was a feminist magazine, there was enough lesbian stuff in them on a regular basis to be of interest to us. And also lesbians advertise things, so like the lesbian ball. Whereas the lesbian magazines were hit and miss, apart from Circle that ran the longest. And we pretty much have a full set of Circle. I think we might be short of one somehow. I think we might have got a photocopy from Nagans of one. One of the very early ones.
So do you think a lot of the initial success of the museum was down to selecting the right trustees for the trust? Was that a crucial thing?
I think that's crucial. Because you don't want to have... Also, the other thing might have been my influence, in terms that I was the driving force, I had the vision, and none of the others really had the vision of what it would even look like when we first started. They weren't quite sure. They'd come to my house, of course. They knew my house was full of stuff, and so it was a bit like a museum itself. So after that, when I first set it up in this lovely white room, it was 100 square metres, it was a big room, and we sealed off part of it with the resources behind, out of sight, and made a display wall at the back of the bookcases, so we had bookcases facing that. And that idea, I mean, they were all creative ideas that I came up with because of this number 8 wire mentality I have. So... though I did meet an Austrian who solved one of our problems. He was as good as me with the number 8 wire, and we used wire to hang up a carving on a pipe. I think because I had the vision and the driving force, that stirred them along, and they tended to leave the displays to me. They just concentrated on the governance and what we needed to do. And to start with, it was a little bit like rubber stamping. They trusted me that I wouldn't run foul of anything because it was so much my vision to do this. And I think that probably helped. It gave them confidence. One of the problems for instance, leasing a space, because you're a charitable trust, no one will lease a space to you unless you have a guarantor. So I personally went guarantor for the rent each time. And I probably still do that in the next place, even though my resources are dwindling. So there's those sorts of things that people who've still got mortgages and so on would be very loath to put their hand up to be a guarantor. So there are some governance problems that could arise for a group setting up if someone was trying to set up a museum.
Why did you think trust? Why a trust?
You need less people in incorporated societies. It's very hard. I belong to a trust. It's now a trust that was an incorporated society, and AGMs were a nightmare. When the first year I was at the museum, you asked before about community involvement. I talked to many, many people around that time, and I had a small group that dwindled away once works wasn't required. Other people came on, and people have come and gone. I've had a range of volunteers over the time, and each of them have learned a lot about museums in that time. But other things crop up, and they move away. But the community involvement, I decided that we should have a sort of like an AGM, maybe, and invite the community to say, you know, what do you like, what do you don't like, what could we be offering more, because we're holding two or three events a month, a lot of events, actually. It exhausted me. and nobody came. I think one person, one meeting certainly, only one person came from the community. She goes to most things, and she writes for the local lesbian newsletter. So that, I thought, for people, and most people said, look, we like what you've done. We are quite happy. We don't have the only suggestions that people have had. So we've done market surveys, we've surveyed people, we put a lot of effort into surveying them, and the only thing they came up with that they'd like was a cafe. Well, that was a bit beyond us. But we've got five tables, folding tables, so we've got chairs. So we're working on that to get the furniture, and I looked up how much it costs to train a barista. But then there's a jump. You need to pay someone, you need a certain amount of... So I suppose we could train a coordinator to be a barista and serve coffee on the side. That's probably how it would come about, and that's a possibility. But it's still out there. So the community has made some suggestions, but they haven't made a lot of suggestions. They've been quite good at pointing out spelling mistakes on the wall, and that's good because I don't see them. I'm a bit dyslexic. I had a stroke years ago. But sometimes they don't realise. They say, oh, I'll proof stuff. But you send it to them, and they'll take two or three weeks to proofread what's only just 400 words. And we've got a deadline with a printer or something to get the money spent so that we can do the accountability in the set amount of time for the funder. And they don't realise those things. And it's fairly hard to say, well, look, you know, I'm sorry, it has to be done fairly quickly. So that sort of poses problems.
Was there any other alternative to being a trust or an incorporated society? Was there any other option for being some other kind of structure?
Not really, not to get funding. The crucial thing about a trust is that you needed to have a trust and a worthy trust board with nobody with bad credentials so that you could get funding, particularly from lotteries and, you know, gaming trusts and so on. And while on the one hand, you know, because we have a political arm of lesbians who think it's really bad to use money from gambling, on the other hand, I see lesbians gambling all the time, and I think, well, other people are using that money. If they don't want to put it into the lesbian community, well, at least we can claw some of it back for lesbian community things. So, on the one hand, I don't like gambling, and I'd hardly ever buy a lotto ticket even. The odds are just dreadful. So, too much of a scientific background, I think. But, you know, there is very little other money around particularly for us. And one thing I suppose we have done is educate all the middle-aged white male businessmen in the country who sit on the boards of gaming trusts that we're out there and we're surviving, and some of them have given us money for various things. And we've been very good at doing the accountability and returning any money we didn't spend because it came in cheaper than we quoted. So they have been educated that we're out there.
So could you take me through the kind of timeline? You've had the idea of the museum. You've developed a trust. Is that when it becomes a charitable trust? Is that
something? Yes, yeah. Yes.
And how long did that take to apply for?
I think we did it in 2006, sent it in maybe at the end of 2006, and we got it in May 2007. At the beginning of 2007, we had our first exhibition, and I just pulled all the posters that I had around in my house, unrolled them, put them into frames that I also took out other things out of, framed as many as I could, and hung them at down the passageway of a gallery who was putting on a thing called the D Thing for Hero. So that was our first exhibition to make us, put us on the planet, really.
So,
and that was before we became the trust.
Wow.
So we did the exhibition and then became a trust, and then I concentrated on applying for funding.
So the initial idea, 2003, first exhibition, 2007. How did you keep the momentum going between 2003 and 2007?
Well, it wasn't really going. It was smouldering. I was busy 2003 cleaning up my house. I then proceeded to put everything up I had in storage, sold the house because the money was crazy, and went to Greece. And so I travelled. Yeah, so really 2006, I was back, bought a house with my son, he's bought a bit of my house, and that was when I unpacked everything and I had all the stuff out. And that was, of course, when Te Papa came to visit and so on. And so it's probably when I unpacked everything, that was the momentum, because I've only just got, I think I'm at the bottom of the boxes, that some of them were packed up in 1994 when I sold the family home where the children had grown up. So they've been lugged around. I'm good at lugging stuff around. In fact, I've just retrieved some books that were stored under the stairs of a friend who's just got her house on the market down in Hamilton. So I lugged all those back out and think, oh, they're all about sexual abuse, so I've got to distribute those. And there weren't many lesbians. Oh, there was a complete set of Naomi Jacob that somebody collected, and I'm looking for somebody who wants to read Naomi Jacob to see whether there's a lesbian subtext in her books, because she was openly lesbian in England, but not, she didn't seem to write lesbian stories at all. So, and in that time, of course, there was a lot of censorship and so on. So I've got lots of interesting projects for other people to do, because I haven't got time. I'm running out of time to do all them myself.
Do you think having like a number of years between having the initial idea and actually having it kind of form is actually a really useful thing, so that you can actually kind of just kind of meditate on the idea of actually what you're forming? Or is it better to have a very short burst of energy to get it up there and get it established?
Well, that's interesting, because you often think, working as an artist, that you get an idea and suddenly you've got all this energy for this idea and you work day and night because you just can't leave it alone. You wake up at night and think, oh, I've got to put the paint there and there, and you know, that sort of frenetic, often is quite frenetic behaviour of not all artists work like that, but certainly a number that I know do, and I tend to be like that. I don't know that one could ever give advice that you should mull over it for a long period of time, or you go with the energy and the flow that you've got. Because basically you do have to have energy and enthusiasm. And I've had a lot of that. And I've worn out probably a few volunteers because I've been so energetic. I don't think I'm probably the easiest person to work with, because I've had the vision and I also want to work quickly. I am not really a plodder. I can plod, but I really like to get stuck in and get things done. So I get frustrated when people keep having morning and afternoon tea breaks and so on. So I'm not a good employee-er, really.
And that's an interesting point about the whole kind of personal, professional relationships you have when you're first starting out, in terms of, you know, like I'm assuming with this museum, because it's very much driven by yourself, the idea to get beyond one person's vision or get beyond yourself? I mean, were there any kind of conflicts with people wanting to support a museum but maybe not wanting to support you?
No, there's never been any conflict. The conflict has been for me to... I did not want it to be... New Zealand's full of one people bands. That's how things happen in New Zealand. One person has a vision and they go off and do it. And then when they die, the vision falls over. We've seen it so many times. And I didn't want that to happen. And I wanted to... That's why the whole thing with my daughter about the and my will is to try and make it sustainable. And that's why I want an employee. I want some driving force who has it as a job, who... So we've got enough money to pay a coordinator who then... has a vested interest in keeping the job. Someone who has a passion about history and museums and is lesbian. And there must be people out there. But there are also the ups and downs of employment. That's, we've had somebody who's right into archives and history and so on, but we couldn't keep her on because of the funding. And that's the tricky part, really, I think. We could sustain a Sunday afternoon thing, possibly, but then again, you would have to have one person driving it, because, or maybe two or three, or a couple, that sort of thing, and that's a possibility. I hope we don't end up down that track, but we could do because of the funding situation. But it makes me cross sometimes when I think that Auckland City 2 or 3 years ago spent $14 million on museums. We should get 5% of that. If we're 5% of the population, and they won't count us, so how can we argue anything different? So there is a lot of inequality. And it would be different if all these other museums had bits and pieces about lesbianism, but they don't. They would trot it out for one little simple display and then pack it away again because it might upset somebody, it might upset one of their benefactors. That's what people worry about, that it upsets a benefactor to have too much lesbian stuff around. If you can find a more difficult topic and set up like a lesbian museum, let me know, I'll switch. I've gone from hard topic to hard, you know, I get harder and harder all the time. I think I might have come to the end of hard topics. I think I need to retire.
So what are some of the other tips you could give me for moving something from a one-person setup to a broader thing that will be sustainable?
We're trying to involve more people from the community, and that's why I persistently... had lots of events of different sorts to try and get a range of people coming to the museum, not just to pay one visit and now I've been to the museum and that's it, but to come back again to see new displays, to see, to take an interest in some aspect, whether it's music or art or poetry or reading or film or whatever. You know, we've never done any research on lesbian film in New Zealand. I mean, that's a big topic in itself, and it'd be great if we could get some funding. But the burden of funding and following it up, making sure you tick all the boxes, the accountability and so on, are very stringent. And I didn't realise how difficult it was when you apply, when we did the music one, for instance, I had to use my own money to get that money released for us. I had to put my own money in to say that we had them, to prove that we had enough money for the project to go ahead, because they allocated the money to us, but they wouldn't release it until we had all the money for the project. Well, it takes time for... And I was busy trying to run things rather than be out there running raffles or doing buckets on the street and so on. So in the end, I think it was about $2,500 I put in to make it happen, to release that other money. Well, that shouldn't be like that. It should not be tied to getting the whole amount, because... especially in a research project like that, there are often ways that you might be able to reduce the costs a little later on when you see that, or as we found out, was no point in going to Dunedin, the person wasn't there. So that was an air flight that we had thought about, and we changed all that. And the travel. They were still arguing over travel to Hamilton, and so I had all these petrol vouchers. So I photocopied all the petrol vouchers and sent that down as proof that we had money for travel. Just an enormous waste of time. Particularly when you feel that you're running out of life and that you need to get these things set up and done. And as it was, in that project, two people died. And since making the film, two more have died. We're running out of time. And they seem to make it hard for us. And whether it's because of their lesbian word or not, it's difficult to know. I'm not sure how hard they make it for others. You don't have time to... We network a bit, but... You don't have time to network enough to get the difficulties that people have with certain funders. Whereas other funders, it's very clear cut that they apply. It mightn't be the whole amount of the grant, but they don't care whether you've got the money for the rest as long as you spend the money on what you said and return back. And I like that sort of system. I don't like the sort of almost feeling blackmailed into providing the whole amount of money before you can even start. I mean, that's bureaucracy gone.
So how much time would you be spending on funding applications?
When I, in 2008, 2009, the amount of time I actually spent on the museum was probably about 70 hours a week. I've whittled it down now, and I probably am doing possibly a 20-hour a week. But I don't want to be doing that. But I don't have anyone else to do it. That's the problem. So it's still... weighing on me, and I'm going away to Berlin. I've fallen in love and very, very happy, and I'm going to spend some time in Berlin from May till September. So it has to function without me, pretty much. I will arrange for the GST either to be delayed, or I can get someone to do that, probably. I will do some work over the internet, of course, I mean, with my email, because I certainly don't want any difficulties on governance issues and so on. So like GST, or if we're paying someone, then there's PAYE that has to go in every month, and that can be tricky for people to wade their way through that. So, and paying bills and things like that. So all that has to be organised. Currently, I do all what a treasurer would normally do in an organisation, as well as the secretarial work. So the trustees really depend on me to keep all that and just report back to them that we've spent this much and we need to cut back or whatever. We need more money, most of it is the call. it's difficult to move it on to having... Because when I look at other trusts I'm on, the CEO or director, and I mean basically they're just like a coordinator, we just use the word coordinator because the emphasis is on coordinating volunteers. Whatever you call the person who runs the place, they tend to be one people places because you can't afford any more staff. You might have, if you're lucky, they've got one in the office, part-time in the office and a director, and mostly that's all you have. And all the organisations that have a paid person, it tends to be one person, or you might have an education officer, so you have two. And that means it's very fragile, a very fragile organisation, because if you don't do the funding, if you lose that person, then you fall over, and you can see that happening with lots of gay organisations.
What's your ideal situation in terms of staffing, in terms of complement of people?
The ideal would be probably a part-time coordinator, not necessarily full-time, but I would think at least, say, 30 hours a week, and maybe a researcher paid for... either for a set project, but probably just so many hours a week. So possibly, say, if you had a 40-hour a week salary and you spent it on 30 hours for a coordinator and 10 hours for a researcher who was possibly retired or at or for, had health reasons, maybe was on sickness benefit and couldn't do very much, but was interested in doing some research and fossicking around and over at the Auckland Museum on things like that. That would be quite good, and some volunteers. That would be the minimum, really, to make it sustainable, I think. I suppose the ideal would be a person, maybe a 40-hour-a-week coordinator and maybe a 30-hour-a-week research/education officer, or maybe two, one research or one education officer, like three people in the office, and you lose time with talking and discussions around the tasks and so on, but then again you gain from more input. But usually this, we've had a few cataloguing days where we've had a number of people, and they worked in pairs cataloguing, one taking out the works with the gloves on and one doing the cataloguing, so we're working all on different laptops and so on, and we managed to get a lot of the things cataloged, and I was interested to find that, you know, Auckland Museum's miles behind on cataloguing what they have and so on. They don't even know what they've got in some places, so we don't feel so bad that we haven't done all our CDs, and we've got masses of cassettes and we haven't started on them. But we've got almost all our posters catalogued. It's only a few that have come in recently that are not. And all the objects are catalogued and also numbered. They've got little numbers on them with the special paper and the special glue. So we've gone to our workshops and we've done all that. So, you know, we're feeling quite good about that. And to get it this far and then be stuck with no funding for a person to run it is a bit sad. That's one of the issues I'd like to take up with the City Council. We're not asking, our budget's $50,000. We're not asking for a lot of money in Super City when they can spend so much on rugby. Just drives nuts. But I won't go there.
So is it important for you to have volunteers, to have that community involvement?
Yes, I think so. I think that's... and there's lots of things, like one of the things, that, you know, just having some people to help out at events, to do the hospitality, make a pot of tea or pour the wine or whatever, you know, that you're doing. That sort of thing. Who might, you know, bring along a plate. All those sorts of things give a sense of being involved in community. And it gives people an opportunity to be involved in something, because so often, you know, the old bring a plate, you know, ladies a plate sort of stuff, gone down the Googler. Now people pay big money to get little canopies that are worth nothing. I'm just amazed at how much is spent on catering that, you know, a can of chickpeas whizzed down in the kitchen whiz and a few crackers would have done the trick.
So can you describe some of the other events that you've used to kind of pull in community and get them interested?
Well, we've had Deb Filler, who comes over to see her mother regularly, so we've had her come to the museum a couple of times. She opened the new premises. She also talked about the theatre, and she did a bit of a prelude to some of her own work. We've had people like that who speak. We've always on Anzac Day, we've done something. So we've had someone who was in the Air Force military police before she came out. She talked about, you know, working there and having to search people's underwear drawers and so on, looking for photographs. And she found that so distasteful that it wasn't very long before she resigned, left her marriage and came out as a lesbian. You know. So that whole, you know, that was really a fascinating oral story that she gave us, and people are still talking about it. And
she was searching for for evidence of lesbian relationships.
Or gay.
And getting and destroying it.
Well, no, she was ordered to find it. She found that so distasteful that it was very difficult. But of course,
what year was that?
That would have been in the '70s. She's trying to think how old she is. It might have been actually in the 80s. We have her jacket. It's interesting that on display we usually have Daisy dressed in an Australian uniform, because the Australian government has gladly given us an Australian Major's uniform for Major Lee Easterbrook, who they chucked out of the Australian Army for being a lesbian. And then when they changed the rules, they wanted her back again, but she wouldn't go back. She only joined the Territorials, but she does do a lot of training in that in the Territorials, but she's very highly regarded by the Australian Army, and they were very happy to give us a complete kit. I wrote to the Wairuru Museum, hoping that they might have some stories about lesbians down there. It took them a year to answer my letter. I think we've got a little bit a way to go with the forces here. We've visited the Navy Museum. We have a good relationship with them, but they haven't sort of uncovered anything. I do know lesbians who were in the Navy, but nothing has been forthcoming. But we offset that for Anzac Day too. By also, we've had a talk about the Pramazons who went from Opotiki to Gisborne, pushing prams with their musical instruments on the prams, promoting nuclear-free New Zealand, and that was 1981. So we've had them, and lots of people from the peace movement came. Some of those are ways of getting the public to come to an event. The public will come on an open day occasionally, but lately we haven't had many because we're a bit hidden where we are. But some of those open events, they'll come. Like the historical societies, we had, we gave a talk to and invited all the historical societies to come about how we collected information. But halfway through, some elderly woman got up and said, "Ooh, we didn't realise it was this sort of a museum," and left. So it shows where people are at. It's still a process and so on. So, but they missed out on the asparagus rolls. It's a bit sad. We always make asparagus rolls at every event.
Because?
So they're easy to make. They're popular. And they're a bit nostalgic for people. I can't even eat them, but I make them. Because I can't eat wheat. So other events, we've run a clown workshop, we've done a life drawing class. That was more difficult because we couldn't use the museum, but we just snuck into a room that was empty next door, so that's how we got around that, because the graphic dust would be too difficult to deal with the museum. So we did learn from that there are limitations to what we can do in terms of workshops. I would like to do a button-making workshop, sort of to celebrate activism. People could come along and make buttons, but we need to raise some money to buy a button maker and a badge maker sort of thing. So that's one of the things in the pipeline.
It's really interesting because a lot of those events are taking historic objects and then doing a current contemporary activity around that.
That's a nice mix. Yes, yeah. That's what we try and do, to make it sort of a little more relevant, but with always some historical background. And we celebrated, for instance, Tweeny Nawai, who we've taken a song of hers, Puti Puti, which is a song to her female lover. We've taken that as our waiata, and we celebrated her centenary. I think a bit of whānau over in Tokomaru Bay were the only people who sort of recognised her centenary, which I thought she was a composer of songs for the Māori Battalion, and she also won the Golden Shears when she was 51. And so 1961, I think it was, when she won the Golden Shears. So, a remarkable woman, but people don't emphasise. We have a beautiful photo of her with a hat and a man's coat on, and it's just stunning. And it's those sorts of things. People just hone in on that photograph. They see her in a Maori dress and so on, but it's that photo where she's with other friends dressed a day at the races or something, that she wore very much male clothing to the races, appeals to people about. And of course, we have a quote from Nahuia Te Awakutuku, who wrote about her, and so as one of the aunties, and sort of, so we quote that as well. So pulling those pieces out, but it all takes time, and that's why you need a researcher really all the time to look for things and so on. To all your displays have to have a lot of research, and most of them I've done. I've had somebody doing research on theatre in a book. Sport in a book, and theatre, music and sport are the three that we've had some research money and people, but there's still the main display. I've not the sports display. The other woman did that. Jan Brown did that. So it's still quite time consuming to get it down to less than 400 words. I sort of aim for now, because I think the poor Te Papa visitor came and he found that he was a bit overwhelmed with the amount of words on the wall. I think it is a bit too wordy.
You mentioned just before about bringing general audiences into the museum, and I'm just wondering, are there any restrictions on who can actually visit the museum and access the material?
None whatsoever, unless someone has deposited something that they would not want anybody else. So everybody signs a form to say that their name, that they agree that their name is next to the object they've donated, and that they don't mind if, say, a television crew came in and I put it on TV One News because of some reason. We haven't been so lucky to get that publicity, but we're working on it. So that sort of thing. So people don't... when people have letters or something, we suggest they send those to Lagans. And I have some stuff that I've collected now from two women who've died that I want to send to Lagans, but until they're set up again, I thought it'll just be sitting down there. I'll just keep it and add to it and so on, so that I've got a good package when I send it off to them. Because I'm sure when I get to the bottom of some of my last boxes, I might find some more bits and pieces that can go in, you know, letters. I've been going through all the letters that I've kept letters for many years. I'm a bit of a hoarder.
What about in terms of the community reaction to the museum in general? When it was first put forward as an idea, how did the community respond?
People thought that's a good idea. And to start with, when we asked for money from the community, some people were very generous and wrote out cheques for hundreds of dollars. And other people, interestingly enough, some of the people who were more well-heeled gave us 10, which is probably why they were more well-heeled. But overall, it's there's been a positive response. But because I'm so well-known in the community, and I do have a certain respect because of the difficult issues that I've dealt with, and the support I've given people who've been raped and sexually abused and so on. So I think that I don't tend to, certainly not in Auckland, I don't tend to get that flack. I get some political flack in Wellington for not crossing T's and dotting I's and doing things that aren't quite PC, I suppose. But I don't get that from Auckland because of my involvement in the community and what I do. And I worked for a long time in the AIDS Foundation as a trustee, and there wasn't a real, like, people questioned my input in that as a lesbian, why was I? And I said, because if it gets in the heterosexual community, a lot of children will get AIDS, because a lot of children are raped and we don't realise how many. But if it's something like 1 in 3 before the age of 16, that's going to be a lot of children that could be at risk. So that was one of the reasons as well as the whole thing, that it was a sort of disease that was going to be get out of hand very easily if we didn't step in. And I thought in New Zealand we had the chance of doing something because we were a small enough country. I also thought we could do something about child abuse back in the 70s because we were a small country, but I failed miserably, and I often get very despondent about that. But the awareness and all the work that I did in the 70s and 80s and 90s has been for naught, really. The figures have not reduced, even though I think the middle class have improved their child rearing. The bottom hasn't. So I think because I've worked in those difficult areas that I do engender a certain respect, and there might be disagreements with the whole idea. There certainly was mixed feelings about having a memorial pole, and we've since moved that out of the main viewing area and decided that a memorial booklet. So that was one idea I had that I liked that didn't work quite so well because it was too raw for some people. Their own ideas, their own feeling of their own mortality was sort of staring them in the face when there were too many cancer deaths on that post. And that's another thing that we could be bitter about, that all the money that was poured into gay men's health and we've got nothing. And we do have probably a higher death rate from cancer because lesbians are notorious for delaying going to the doctor. Worse than straight men, and that's fairly bad. So we did the research, but we haven't got any. We had, I think Health's published a couple of pamphlets, and that's about all we've had. So we do feel maligned in some areas, and health is one of them. And so we've tried each year to have a health sort of seminar at the museum with a few health things, and that's mostly because of my interest, and I did that health research back in 98, 99. And so, yeah, I've sort of tried to keep that going, having some health in there as well, which is not so related to museums other than homophobia and the history of homophobia. So we can tie it in that way. Mm. And we often... we've had a display at various times about the media, how the media looks at lesbians and gays, and we did a study, I think I did a first study back in 78, we did another one in 82, or was it 80 and 82, and then we've done one, we had a look at more recently in 2008, it might have been, and we put that together for a display, so, and we talked about that, and so on. So we do sort of try and bring in some things that are really topical, but looking at it from a historical perspective as well.
Mm-hmm. What about donations from the community in terms of objects or artefacts? Was that right from the get-go, people were giving you material?
Yes, yes. Oh, people were, oh, great, I'm moving house, you can have all my broadsheets and lots of lesbian books. We've got about 1,800, I think, lesbian books now. Some of my older non-fiction books I have put in there, but I also already had somebody else's collection who'd left New Zealand, and so her collection really started the Charlotte Museum collection, and then I added to it. In my catalogue, I haven't got them all in my house now because I'm at the museum, I think I've got something like 2,900 and something books, lesbian books, so that's an enormous collection, and some of them are very, very rare. Those ones are still at my house because I'm worried about having rare books unless they're very secure. And I think probably some of the rare books possibly need to have a locked glass cabinet because they'll be the only copy, some in Australia and New Zealand. Now, if there were, there's one book, I think there was a print run of maybe only 1,000 books in the whole of the United States, so... And it's a novel, but it's set after the Second World War, so it's actually very poignant because it's really, she only wrote one novel, so it's pretty autobiographical. And I think it tells you of the situation of women coming out of the forces then and the pressure to get married, to have children, really to breed the next lot of warriors, breed the cannon fodder, is how you feel after you look at those sort of historical situations. And, of course, the emphasis after the Second World War was that lesbianism was a mental illness. That wasn't emphasised in the 20s at all. Not even in the 30s, if you look at files of lesbians in Oakley Hospital. But when you look at the 50s, it was, you know, treat them, change them, make them straight. Get them out there to breed.
The types of donation, can you describe for me... things like, you know, the size and the kind of scope of the stuff that you're receiving?
Well, we get T-shirts. We've had a little bit of jewellery donated to us. Carvings. We've had a carving. We're still trying to trace down who did the carving. We've had little bits of memorabilia, travel things, posters. We've got two... capes, pink flight capes from the pink flight from last year, I think it was. Various hero bits, lots of posters over the years, posters, magazines from all over the world and in different languages. We've got Japanese, we've got Spanish, we've got Italian, we've got books in different languages as well. We don't all read all the... I mean, I have some in French and German, which I have read, but I can sort of read a bit of Italian, but mostly because of the French. and I've got very rusty. So, what else do we get? People give us... Sometimes they give us a whole assortment of things, and some of it's not really... it's just a bit junky. And when we've asked, oh, just sort through, you know, those sort of people will tend to drop a box by the door. It's the end of their moving out, and they just put things aside that they didn't want. But mostly it's been appropriate stuff. Some have given us books that are more, that are not lesbian but are feminist, one or two health books about women, and we've tended to keep those if they were, if they were feminist, but if they were just an ordinary health book, we wouldn't keep it. So we have a list of categories for keeping things, and so they have to be pretty much lesbian for us to keep, particularly objects, and that would be unlikely to keep any object. We have a chair that was made by a lesbian, and it has an interesting history that it was part of a set of chairs, beautifully made, beautiful woodwork. They were made for Creative New Zealand for around their board table. That was very, very thin. If you were big, I think you might have broken them. Apparently they did have some problems later on. But this one wasn't quite perfect, which was why she had it, and she's gone back to England now. And so she... So we have the little story about this chair, and that's sitting in the museum. So that's a bigger object. Lots of LPs. People have kept their LPs, but they have long since don't have a turntable. So we have the turntable, and so we have a lot of those given to us. We've CDs. We inherited the Lesbian Radio from Christchurch CDs collection, so that's good. But we haven't catalogued them all. That's a long process, cataloguing LPs and CDs, because you've got to write down the who wrote the song, the lyric, you know, the music, the lyrics, who's singing it, the band, and so on. So it's a lot of information to put in, so that's slow and tedious, and we don't get a lot of volunteers doing that. We did have one person work really solidly for a year. Every Sunday she did an hour or so. She was very, very good on that. So then her circumstances changed and she lost her job, so things become much more stressful for her. So yeah.
And you were saying that you have a specific lesbian policy for defining actually what you mean by lesbian.
Yes, yes.
And is that because of what you're collecting, and so you refer back to that saying, is this actually a lesbian object, or...
Don't usually have to refer back to it. I've just about forgotten what's in the policy. But it's mostly to emphasise that we are a lesbian museum, and that's what we're there for. And we're not... I mean, we do have some gay stuff, of course, because the Pink Flight's both, and lots of hero stuff, and of course we've got a certain amount, but we don't have boxes of condoms around and things. I mean, there is, I suppose, a good thing maybe for the AIDS Foundation to have the range of how they've advertised condoms over the years. You know, there's a whole lot of history, a health history in that, but no, we don't do that. And I can't think of... things on display are pretty much lesbian. You know, there's a beautiful kitty, but it is very vulval in its shape and so on, and it was designed that way by a lesbian weaver. So that's sort of there and appropriate, I feel.
Are there items in the collection which maybe the artist wouldn't see as lesbian or wouldn't particularly want to be in a lesbian museum?
That might be true. I'm just trying to think whether that... I think there's a little dish that shows a woman's... part of a woman's sort of bottom and hips or something. It's not bawdy or anything. It's just... it's really pleasant. Well, I don't know who the art... We don't know who made that. There are a number of things that we don't know who made, but a lesbian has owned and liked them because they represent some aspect of loving women, really. So, trying to think whether there's anything that... there probably is the odd... one thing. We've got a couple, I think, of jar. I think there's a jar and a tin with Lezo on it, that apple tea. I'm sure the Turks who made that did not expect it to be in a lesbian museum, but lots of women don't even drink the stuff, but they have a can on their cupboard or up with their tea caddies and so on. So we've added that to our sort of domestic wear, you know, where we have hers towels and that sort of thing. So I suppose there are a few bits and pieces around that could be queried, and we could have problems with the artist. And that's always a problem, that the artist has one idea in mind, the person who purchases had another idea in mind, and a curator might even have another idea. So you can have three different points of view about an object. And who's to say who has the deciding factor? In terms of a tūhunga, then you would think that the artist would probably have the most important decision. But then the person who owned it and had a different view about it and who deposited it with the museum would possibly have certainly a stronger one than a curator who came in from the cold and had not lived with the object. And the artist who makes something and doesn't live with the object, you know, you do start to wonder about who has the most input in terms of how that is representative, because it might be quite representative of this person's lesbian life, for instance, and is very significant for them. It's
so all of those issues, are they kind of managed or contained within your policy documents? Because I'm thinking, well, who actually decides how things are catalogued, how things are framed, what's collected? Who does that?
The people receiving things, so it's usually the coordinator or myself or another volunteer. And the guidelines are fairly clear cut. Or everybody's who works there is a lesbian, so we don't have to argue about what's lesbian and what's not as a general rule. I can't think of anything that... Well, we have had a few queries about certain books. How lesbian is it? Now, if it's an older book, we usually tend to rely on the Greer bibliography. But she was an American woman, and there are some English books she might have missed. She was a librarian, and she did an enormous bibliography in 1980. And I tried to update it a bit with a new lesbian literature bibliography. But I missed a lot because in New Zealand you didn't, and the internet wasn't as big as it is now. So there are probably some that we might like. Elizabeth Bowen, I know two of her books we have, and somebody gave us a whole, I think there were six books of hers. Well, I don't think they're lesbian, and I don't think we should probably keep them because we're becoming short of space, and where we before we tended to collect, if we had two copies, we kept two copies and gave the third one away. Now we're sort of reducing that back to think one copy is quite sufficient, really, because of space and so on. You know, there is a limit.
Can you take me through the process of if I was depositing some material with the museum, what would happen? How does that go?
Well, you would probably send us an email and say that you wanted to drop something off, and then you would arrange a time when we were open. They call in on Wednesday afternoon or something like that, and that's happened. We've had a number of people do that, and then they show us what they have. For instance, a woman who's no longer lesbian who came in with a whole pile of stuff from her lesbian phase, so to speak, and she was a musician, and so she had some beautiful big backdrops that were painted by a lesbian, whom we think still a lesbian, and also gave us some VCRs which she wanted back, but she didn't come back for them, but we carefully copied them onto, because we have a recorder where we can copy them onto DVD, and So we went through, made a long list of things, and she was in a hurry. So she did have a couple more things she wanted to bring back, and she did come back with those, and we had the list then all down for her to sign. Now, all those were related to a lesbian band, and so, or a band that had lesbians playing, and it was predominantly seen as lesbian, and she was seen as lesbian at the time. So we took all that because we could see a fabulous display and exhibition with her, that stuff, representing the music of that time, and because we've made the film and we've got a display up on, which she's mentioned on our display board. So another person came in with a pile of books and said, oh, well, if you don't, you know, just chuck out anything you don't want or pass on to the Women's Centre or whatever. And other things come from the Women's Centre. They're always dropping off books that are surplus to their requirements. And so we go through and one area that's a bit problematic is poetry, women's poetry, because we don't always know how lesbian they are or whether the person was a lesbian. And so we've probably got some books that we've actually catalogued and kept that are not particularly lesbian. Well, for instance, Sylvia Plath's books. Now, while I think one of them is recorded in the Greer catalogue from memory, I think we've got all her collected poems, probably. Some that are probably read widely by lesbians. So there's a bit of that creeps in. It's a bit hard. I could see that we could get stricter later on. Books are easy enough to deacquisition, really. It's not a major, like, what do you do with an object if you've changed your mind? We would be much stricter about objects. We don't want a whole household lot arriving on our doorstep that, you know, that someone had carved "I love you" on their dressing table top or something. No, we don't go quite that far.
So when somebody donates something, are they gifting it completely to you? Do they retain ownership, or are you acting as a guardian? How does that work?
No, they give up ownership, and the trust is really the guardian for the lesbian community. We believe the objects are really, once they're in the museum, belong to the lesbian community, and whatever that is, you know, a nebulous form, really. But it means that our whole group could, in fact, get together and say they didn't want something in the lesbian museum because it was, they thought it was detrimental or something like that. They could come and debate that with us. That would be fine. And in a way, several people made comments about the memorial post, which was why we then moved it and thought, well, yes, it could be sensitive if you've just lost a loved one or that you've just been diagnosed yourself with cancer. We've had a number of people sort of feel a bit not so good, whereas other people are just spend all their time. They hardly look at the rest of the museum. They're busy looking over who was that, and they have almost a morbid interest on who's on our dead list, really. So you can't win in some of these instances. But I think a nice memorial book and then building up, and when we've got so many people, then you do another one, is possibly the best way to go. It's quite very time consuming trying to get the information, birth, even just the birth and the death dates, and preferably something where they lived or what they did or something. It's quite difficult. We've got a couple of women who suicided in the early days, and we have photographs of them, but we have so little information. So I'm a bit loath to know what to do, but I think we need to keep them there and have them in the memorial book. But I guess if someone comes up with some information at some point, we might be able to add it in anyway. You could just paste it in. So yes, there's plenty of problems. Every project has more problems.
What happens if the trust dissolves or stops? Is there any contingency plan for this material to go somewhere else?
Yes, it would be... one would ask around for an appropriate museum, and it probably the Auckland Museum would be where it would be deposited, and it would probably be weeded out. Certainly all the books and papers would go to Largans. That would make sense. All the biographical stuff, a lot of that will go to Largans earlier anyway. We will only keep photocopies and copies of photos eventually, because we don't have the best storage facilities. So that makes sense for all that to go. But until it's in some decent order, it's no point sending muddly bits down to Lugans. I mean, it's volunteer run too. And so it's no good just passing on things that are only half finished. So it's a case of getting something complete and then sending it off, and why it's significant. You know, what it needs to be someone who did something in the community, and who was out, really. I don't know. There might be a case for someone who was very closeted for some particular reason, but I think that's the safest way to have biographical stuff. But we often see bits and pieces in the newspaper and cut out and think, oh, she's a lesbian and she got a, you know, a ovation for doing something good in the community. We'll cut out that newspaper clipping and file it away, or else it's filed in a box under alcohol or aging or some other thing. We have all these boxes with labels on too, are full of bits of paper and that needs sorting.
You mentioned right at the very start of the chat that the choosing of a name, you didn't realise the kind of implications of choosing a name, and I'm assuming that's because you chose something like museum. Is that correct?
Yes.
What are the implications of, like, I mean, if I'm not quite sure what the differences are between, like, say, an archive and a museum or a library. What?
A library suggests that it's either a research library or a lending library. We only have a research library. We don't lend, other than to a bona fide researcher who's usually paid by us, who can sometimes borrow books. An archive, you have to have really good conservation requirements of temperature and humidity for looking after paper. And I knew that as an artist, about the problems with foxing on prints and things, because I was a printmaker for a long time and all my early prints are no good. So you learn the hard way about acid on hands and things. You can see where people have touched them early on, probably me as well as anybody else. And a museum, what I didn't know was the connotation, if you set yourself up as a museum, that suddenly Department sticks their head up above the parapet and takes a big interest in what you might have. Auckland Museum was also interested that we had somebody's work that they would be interested in. And I knew what they would do. They would put it out in some display, but nothing about lesbian. So that made me more determined that it needed to be a separate entity. It would be a shame for it to fold, because I see a large number of lesbians who are middle class, who are reasonably well off, who will be coming up to retirement age in another 15 years, and it's a nice little hobby for them to be involved in. They'll all need an interest. They'll live a lot longer than they expected, for those that have maintained health. And so I think, at the moment, we're in this difficult phase of not probably having enough people in that category. A lot of still, because they took a long time to even get a house, because you had to have a, you know, even Lindsay Ray was saying the other day her father had to guarantee her mortgage when she was, and that was 1982. So we're on the back foot in terms of when we get to retirement, we don't have big funds. And so many of them will continue to work on or take on contract jobs and so on, possibly until they're closer to 70. But then we'll have a bigger population who will, in fact, be retired and will be wanting something to do, and who may have an interest in research or books or some aspect of perhaps organising events, like whether it's a book club or discussion group or something on a regular basis. I think we will see more of those things happening again, like we had in the early days. Perhaps. I mean, I'm hopeful that will, and the museum will fulfil that function. Certainly, there's been lots of people have enjoyed the number of events that we've held and the wide variety of events, and felt that it's brought the community back together a bit and given more opportunity for older lesbians to get together. But now it seems it's very hard to attract younger lesbians. The museum seems old and not of interest to them. But when they come, they're completely overwhelmed by all the information and go away very happy. And there tends to be a few more come after them. After we had about 12 from Unitech came, then there was a regular student sort of came and wandered in to check out the museum. So the word of mouth sort of helps. We give out lots of brochures, but we don't get a big return. From the big day out, I gave over 1,000 brochures, and I haven't had anyone from who picked up a brochure there that I've talked to who's come in since then. So it's a long trickle effect. Lots of people know about us on Facebook, but that's all they do. They want, put up some more pictures on Facebook. And I'm reluctant to put too many pictures up, or go online and just have a virtual museum, because it's not the same as seeing an object and seeing all around an object. A two-dimensional or three-dimensional is quite different. And there's the whole atmosphere and the information on the wall, which you can't put all that on Facebook. Or Twitter. We do tweets too. We have a Twitter account. So we're sort of up to speed for some old people.
It sounds quite interesting. I suppose coming into this chat, I was thinking, oh gosh, the idea of continually progressing, continually growing is the kind of optimum. But actually, on reflection now, after we've chatted, I'm thinking, is there anything wrong with an organisation that contracts and expands and contracts and expands depending on what the community wants? As long as it keeps going in some form, it might take different forms at different stages, but if you wait 15 years, you'll get another surge of people coming through.
Yes, I think it can vary. And also, there's nothing to say that the whole world won't swing to the right. In times of poor economic times, fascism looks really good. And so lesbians and gay men will be more at risk, but particularly lesbians will be much more vulnerable in those sort of times. So they'll need some sort of haven, some sort of where we can plot and plan in the middle of the night, so to speak. So yes, but as well as that, it could retrench so that, as I say, just a small display of the collections, and even rotating them if you haven't got enough display space. You know, I've thought about that, and while I'm looking for premises now, well, four of us looking for premises, we all have that in mind, that we could, that's seen as going backwards, but it's also a way of, the big thing is sustainability, and that's what my pledge is, really. And I think the trustees have got the general idea of sustainability, but they haven't quite seen, partly because I've done so much work, they haven't realised how much work has gone into, you know, all the funding applications and so on. And I think that's a bit harder to get over to people. I mean, certainly two people on the trust probably know how much work I do, because they're also involved in organisations that do a lot of funding, and they know how difficult some departments are when you're trying to get funding from them. So,
I guess just to wrap up, could you bullet point the key things that somebody just starting out with an idea like this would be useful in kind of giving to them some tips?
The first one, they need a lot of energy. You need to have an organisation that is set up in such a way that you can receive funding. And you need to be able to account for all your funding very well. So you need good governance. And it needs to be a project that has a community that would either use it or respond to it or favour it or something. You know, it's like I guess the ceramic museum that's being set up out at New Lynn. Now, you wouldn't set that up in Waiheke because there's no history of ceramics in Waiheke, but there's a big history of crumb brick from the very first brickworks at the beginning of the establishment of anything out in New Lynn. from colony times. So that makes sense. So you need to have a look of why you're doing something, you know, where you've come from. You know, it's like a canoe, really. Yeah, you need to know where you've paddled from to know where you're going to paddle to. That sort of concept, I think, is important to have clearly in your mind. And lots of willing workers, willing volunteers, really. And some good benefactors would be even better. I mean, that would be amazing to actually own. The ultimate would be if someone leaves us a building of either a flat that they've lived in that either we could turn into a museum or that you could rent out and make yourself sustainable. Those are the things that are on the back of our mind, and we do have on our website about bequests. And we've had a couple. Well, I see the radio, lesbian radio, as a bequest in terms of all the cassettes we got from them. And we had a small bequest from Bronwyn Dean. So, you know, we do say bequests are very nice. Be nice if, you know, people remember us in our will, in their wills. But, you know, that's, again, people are nervous about mortality, I've discovered, more so than practically I am, I suppose. So having lived past all predictions, I suppose I don't worry so much about it. And I can't think of anything else. I do think you have to develop rigorous policies, the only way is to call it policies, like rules really, about how your organisation is to run and so on, so that you don't end up with difficulties, either with someone with their hand in the till or racing off with all the petrol vouchers or things like that. I mean, those are little things that, but they give an organisation a bad name if you have to, you know, catch someone doing things like that. And that you don't break rules in terms of that you don't do things out of ignorance. Like one of the problems we have, for instance, in the conservation area, that you really need the temperature fairly even. And of course in the winter time you come in and the building we're in now it's 9 degrees. So basically I said do what you have to do with your coat on and everything and go home and do other things on the net. Otherwise you're heating the room up and letting it go down again. And that's really bad for things. It's better to stay at 9 degrees over the whole day, or slightly go up and then down to 12 and down again, than to you come and boost it up to 20 with all the heaters on and the big electricity bill. And for what? You know. So we tend to, last year I think we closed in July and August, and we will probably do the same this year unless we've got a very insulated or automatically heated space. So, yeah, I can't think of anything else, really.